Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi of the National Iranian American Council, who examines the impact of President Trump's withdrawal from the International Iran Nuclear Agreement on future talks with North Korea and the looming threat of war. Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who assesses the significance of a ceasefire between Afghan government troops and Taliban insurgents, the first since the U.S. invasion 17 years ago. And Mirka Dominguez-Salinas of Make the Road Connecticut, and Megan Fountain of Unidad Latina en Acción, who address a rally in Hartford, Connecticut, protesting the Trump administration's policy of separating families seeking asylum in the U.S. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During this spring's massive Great Return March protests along the Gaza-Israeli border, local Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, who spent 22 years in an Israeli prison, fully supported the grassroots resistance to Israel's Gaza blockade. He said the protests, which left 120 dead and 2,700 injured, was a new phase in the Palestinian national struggle on the road to liberation. Over the years, Sinwar, who has deep ties to Hamas's military and intelligence operations, has developed a contradictory reputation as a militant and a realist. Sinwar understands the realities of Middle East politics and the power of the Israeli military. Hamas has repeatedly shown its willingness to negotiate with Israel, such as proposing a truce after a recent missile attack against Israel that in turn triggered Israeli airstrikes against Gaza. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Sinwar is popular in Gaza, where frustration has grown over the densely populated territory's economic blockade and 44% unemployment. In early May, he spoke to Gaza's young people, where many like him are descended from refugees and are bitter about what good the future might hold when their daily lives are so bleak. "We would rather die as martyrs than die out of oppression and humiliation," he told them. "We are ready to die, and tens of thousands will die with us." The European Union is rewriting its laws governing digital data privacy. The EU is now enforcing its new General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which allows internet users to opt out of having their web activity collected by website companies. The act imposes stiff penalties for noncompliance. Since the dawn of the internet age, tech giants such as Google and Facebook have made billions in profits by surveilling and profiling online users in every corner of the internet and delivering big data to advertisers. Privacy advocates say that the EU's new digital privacy law will put a big dent in Google and Facebook's European profits. Under the new law, consumers must consent to having their data collected, stored, and processed. Moreover, tech companies must inform users of a data breach within 72 hours. Penalties for violations of data privacy could run 20 million euros, or 4% of a company's global revenue. Some news reports maintain that Google and Facebook would benefit from GDPR because smaller startup rivals won't be able to pay for the compliance burden. However, many observers hope that GDPR will become a global standard that puts individual privacy ahead of surveillance-based profit. In the shadow of prosperous cities in the Pacific Northwest, scores of highly organized homeless villages have been established to provide a safe, secure environment for homeless people. Contrary to the perception that homelessness generates street crime, such villages help to reduce crime in surrounding neighborhoods. In 5 of 11 homeless villages surveyed by the Guardian newspaper, crime in a broad range of categories decreased in the surrounding neighborhood after they were established. In 4 cases, any change was small, within single digits. In 2 neighborhoods, crime increased. Kenneth Leon, a criminologist at George Washington University, says the Guardian's data is consistent with the position that homeless villages are not generators of crime and could be part of a crime prevention ecosystem. The numbers show there's no evidence homeless encampments add to crime, wrote Michael Males, senior research fellow at the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice in San Francisco, calling the figures an important finding. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After aggravating tensions with and launching personal attacks against some of America's closest allies over trade issues at the G7 gathering of Western leaders in Quebec, Canada, President Trump arrived in Singapore for his much-anticipated summit meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. While there was hope that the groundbreaking talks between Washington and Pyongyang could pave the way for peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, many observers noted that Trump has demonstrated that he's much more adept at smashing international agreements than building consensus to negotiate new accords. The U.S.-North Korean summit meeting concluded with positive optics, but was very short on substance. In his first year and a half in office, Mr. Trump has broken or disrupted important international treaties or agreements, including his withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement, pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Treaty, and initiated talks to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico and Canada. But the president's most consequential decision on international agreements to date was his violation and withdrawal from the International Nuclear Agreement with Iran, which could set off a new nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, Vice President of Policy with the National Iranian American Council. Here he assesses the impact of Donald Trump's pullout from the Iran nuclear agreement on future talks with North Korea, as European nations try to salvage the Iran agreement, obliterated by the U.S., that could lead to war.
I think it's very difficult for any party to trust that the United States will keep its word on an agreement. You had some examples of this already affecting the talks with North Korea. And that's, when John Bolton came out and said that they envisioned the Libya model for North Korea, that sort of evoked the memories of Libya giving up its, WMD and capabilities, and then Gaddafi being toppled and the United States supporting his toppling. And so you already have that sort of as a backdrop. With Iran, you actually have a situation where we were in the midst of an agreement that Iran was fully upholding. The latest IAEA, International Inspectors report just came out a couple of days ago and confirms Iran was completely compliant with the nuclear deal. And so I think that this, for any rational actor, this raises serious concerns about how much we can, the U.S. can actually be relied on. Now, an interesting note, Trump has actually said that he, unlike Obama with the Iran deal, he plans to submit an agreement with North Korea to the Senate for ratification. And this is the big criticism of how Obama secured the Iran deal. There was no ratification process. It did go before Congress. Congress had an opportunity to vote it down through this sort of unique mechanism that was passed into law specifically for the Iran deal. But that did not codify the Iran deal into law. It did not codify it as a treaty. And so what opponents of the deal, they criticize it for that. And Trump, being the anti-Obama, has even said for this North Korea deal, unlike the Iran deal, which he supposedly is completely justified in backing out of, this is going to be a treaty. And I think that that's going to be a tall order. But it does show the difference in style, at least, where Obama, spent, over nearly 3 years in negotiations with Iran, this very carefully crafted agreement, and sort of needed to navigate the domestic politics, which made it really difficult to strike this deal because there were very powerful U.S. domestic interests lobbying against it, as well as outside foreign interests lobbying against it. And so he ended up striking the Iran deal, which was pretty far-reaching, but did not necessarily offer as many concessions as perhaps could have been positive to do in order to secure more Iranian concessions. You know, so that the deal was only a nuclear deal. It didn't lift the U.S. embargo, all these things. With Trump, he's sort of, you know, it's more of a bull in a china shop approach. And we'll see sort of how the domestic politics affect this, but also how his decision to kill the Iran deal ends up influencing the party at the other side of the table as far as the willingness to actually sign on to something that may not actually be a deal that lasts into the next presidency.
There are many observers who look at Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran International Nuclear Agreement, along with statements from his national security advisor, John Bolton, and newly named Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, as revealing that the intention here all along might be to pursue war and regime change in Iran. And I'm wondering how likely you think that outcome is, and where does the peace movement in the United States come into play here in terms of that very dangerous and deadly option, if that's indeed what the Trump administration is after?
I really think that similar to, you know, 2002, 2003, in the lead up to Iraq, there was this idea that the United States could have a massive invasion and war on the cheap, and that this was going to be sold as this very clean operation with limited boots on the ground, and we were going to be able to sort of have our cake and eat it too. Today, I think with Iran, the version of that is this notion that the United States is going to sort of help topple the Iranian regime, and that the regime is so close to the brink of collapse that if the United States imposes new sanctions and then potentially does some of the things that John Bolton has talked about, such as supporting ethnic separatist groups inside of Iran, arming terrorists and things like that to try to destabilize the country, and that is somehow a way that the United States can actually take this bad actor off of the map without having to pay too high of a cost. And so I think that the challenge for the peace movement is to really to not wait until it's too late and until we've gone so far down that path that an actual war is inevitable and you have the, you know, you have this administration having sold the American people on this notion that Iran is tied to Al-Qaeda, which is something, you know, a propaganda point that Mike Pompeo is a big fan of and which is starting to gain traction once again and is complete nonsense. But I really think for the peace movement, it's going to be a matter of standing up now and calling this stuff out now and not allowing this to get so far down the road that we're unable to actually stop it.
That was Jamal Abdi, Vice President for Policy with the National Iranian American Council. Find links to more news and commentary on Trump's violation of the Iran nuclear agreement and the threat of war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Afghanistan's President Ashraf Ghani announced on June 7th that the Afghan army will observe a temporary ceasefire with Taliban insurgents from June 12th through the 19th, coinciding with the end of the holy month of Ramadan during the Muslim holiday known as Eid al-Fitr. Ghani said military operations against other armed groups, such as the Islamic State, will continue. 2 days later, the Taliban announced that they too would also observe a three-day ceasefire during the holiday. The ceasefire is the first such declared truce since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. The ceasefire was announced just days after a gathering of Afghanistan's top Islamic clerics in the capital of Kabul, where they issued a fatwa, or religious edict, against suicide bombings. However, the religious gathering itself was the target of a suicide bombing that killed at least 7 people. And as the ceasefire got underway on June 12th, Taliban fighters killed a district governor and 8 others in northern Afghanistan. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who recently returned from a trip to Afghanistan. Here she assesses the significance of the recently announced ceasefire, the drought that has stricken 22 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces, and a 400-mile walk for peace recently undertaken by Afghan men.
Well, you know, I'm told that ceasefires are often very, very fragile and hard to sustain. And yet that doesn't mean that it's not a step toward a peace process. So I don't want to sound terribly negative, but I guess, you know, we should just acknowledge that the Taliban have been surrounding Afghan cities like Kunduz in the north or in the western area of Baha, and taking them over for a short time and then withdrawing as a sort of as a sign of their strength. And they have control over roadways leading to cities such that the reality is that the Afghan government is not declaring a ceasefire and therefore they're going to stop offensive attacks. They're really declaring a ceasefire, but they're the ones on the defensive. The Taliban has said, okay, for the 3 days that mark the end of Ramadan, we also will declare a ceasefire. But you see, Ashraf Ghani's and General Nicholson's version of the ceasefire is exclusive to the Taliban. That doesn't mean they'll stop attacking Islamic State in the Khorasan province, ISKP, or you could just consider that Islamic State. There are many, many different warring insurgent groups run by various warlords within Afghanistan. So that makes it all the more difficult to declare a ceasefire, because who's really in on the ceasefire? Certainly the Taliban are the strongest.
What are the prospects for peace, in your view, in terms of negotiations between the Afghan government under Ashraf Ghani and the Taliban?
Well, I don't think that the war can be ended without negotiations. And it's a terrible shame that President Trump has said he won't engage in any negotiations and he doesn't approve of talks. But that doesn't mean that talks aren't happening. I think negotiations are crucial. I don't think either side can gain a military victory. This has gone on for such a very long time. And yet, if you talk about a lasting peace, I think it has to be predicated on creation of jobs and incomes for people. Because when people are desperate, they have to feed their families, they have to find water. Then, given that the money that's in the country is wrapped up with military groups, you'll see continued cooperation with military groups. People don't want to do that, but they don't have other means of earning an income.
Tell us to what extent Afghanistan has been afflicted by this drought across the region.
Well, right now, out of 34 provinces in Afghanistan, 21 are afflicted by drought. And, you know, in drought-ridden countries, water wars break out, and it's hard to imagine that more water wars won't take place within Afghanistan. Already there's fighting going on over access to water or over creation of dams that moves water in a different direction. And when people flee, and they generally go to the cities, I'm most familiar with Kabul, these are cities that have been battered by war and their water systems are already inadequate. And climate change has just dealt a terrible deck of cards to Afghanistan. You know, the water is contaminated. You have to boil every drop of drinking water. And, you know, it's humiliating for families if they can't get water for cleaning, for laundering.
Kathy, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to make sure to have you talk about the peace walk, where men have undertaken a walk advocating a peaceful resolution to this long conflict in Afghanistan. Tell us about this walk and the motivation for the folks engaged in the walk.
Well, you know, it's a real heart in your throat sort of thing. Are they going to make it safely to Kabul? They're so vulnerable. They started out as 9 men, and they had done a 2-month vigil in the Helmand province following a suicide bombing. And they were in a tent. Women were in the tent as well, which is really unusual because this is such a conservative area. And they were asking that the Taliban and the Afghan government stop fighting. And these very determined people, even though other such vigils in other cities had kind of wrapped it up and said, you know, nobody's giving us a positive answer, that we don't hear negotiations surfacing from the government or from the Taliban. But they said, okay, we're going to roll up our tent, and they put on their sandals and declared intent to walk 434 miles from Helmand to Kabul. And they said, our walk will strengthen our movement. And they've been right. It's very heartening as they go to various cities. You know, they arrive and their feet are bloodied and blistered and torn. They are met by people who say, we are with you. And now their numbers have swelled. Dozens of people are walking. Throngs of people come to them when they arrive in cities. And when I was there, I heard from numerous people who said, yes, we approve of them. We're going to welcome them. So we have to hope that there won't be an attack when these very brave and yet very vulnerable people arrive in Kabul.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Learn more about Kelly's work and find a link to her recent article titled Digging Deeper by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The immigrant rights movement has been outraged and energized by the recent murder of two immigrant women on the U.S.-Mexico border and by the new Trump administration policy of separating parents seeking asylum in the U.S. from their children. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, often sends children of detained immigrants thousands of miles away, and many parents are not told where they are. In response to the violence and the government policy of separating families, protests were held across the U.S. in recent days. On June 7th, about 150 people gathered in Hartford, Connecticut, outside the federal building that houses Immigration Court, to denounce the killings and the separation of parents from their children. One Hartford protest organizer dipped her hand in red paint and applied handprints across the faces of a dozen protesters to symbolize the violence against immigrants at the border. Activists from several groups spoke, followed by a die-in in front of the building, which police attempted to break up by threatening to arrest participants who didn't leave. Most opted to leave civil disobedience for another day. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the protest rally and brings us two of the speeches delivered there. We hear first from Mirka Dominguez Salinas, an organizer with the group Make the Road Connecticut.
Over 7,000 people have been killed. Seven, let that sink in. This is not just a number. This, every single one was a person. And we, I Make the Road, envision a world where children aren't ripped apart from their families, where people aren't murdered for wanting a better education, where people aren't denied their basic human rights and die because of this. How many more have faced abuse and violence and lived through that and have to live with that trauma? There's no way that these numbers could ever be accurate. This violence and abuse is so systemic that we would never know the full extent of it. But it's spaces like this that we want to create and build community, because it's not going to take a day to change things. It's not going to take 2 days. It's not even going to take a month, right? It's going to take years of creating spaces like this to really change things. And on a local level, we've been working with families who, these two community members were walking down Franklin Ave and were detained, profiled or whatever it was. This is happening every day in our communities, okay? This is not just something that's happening in the news. Yes, it's happening at the national level, but it's happening in your neighborhoods. So we need to stand up against that and say, what is wrong with these people that they are tearing families apart? These two mothers are in danger of being deported. And that is not okay, and that is why we're here, because we won't stand for that.
That was Mirka Dominguez Salinas of Make the Road Connecticut. Next is Megan Fountain with Unidad Latina en Acción, who is in grad school at the University of Connecticut.
I'm studying history, so I wanted to share a little bit of the history of what we're seeing today, because what we're seeing today with immigrants in cages and children in cages is not new. Before the War on Terror by the George W. Bush administration, there was no ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It was Bush who created ICE and put immigration under the Department of Homeland Security and treated immigrants as terrorists and criminals. It was also Bush who started Operation Streamline. And we just heard Trump and Jeff Sessions announce that they are starting a zero tolerance policy, and every immigrant who turns themselves in at the border seeking asylum will get charged with a crime of illegal entry or illegal re-entry. Well, this is not new. This is Operation Streamline, which began in 2005. These are factories of courts, which make a mockery of justice. About 40 immigrants are brought into the courtroom and they are tried en masse. That is not justice. They have maybe 1 minute to speak with a public defender before they plead guilty and they get sentenced to 6 months for illegal entry or up to 20 years for illegal re-entry. Now, unfortunately, this has been a bipartisan project, and the Obama administration increased prosecutions 130%. So that, yeah, you can say boo. So now illegal entry and illegal re-entry are the most prosecuted crimes in federal courts today. And Trump has pledged that 100% of people who come to the border, even people who come, mothers, fathers with children, who come and ask for asylum, which is recognized by the international community as a human right, they are now getting charged with a crime, and their children are being snatched away and put into cages. So, is this new?
No.
But are we going to end it?
Yes.
That was Megan Fountain, an activist with Unidad Latina en Acción, preceded by Mirka Dominguez-Salinas, an organizer with the group Make the Road Connecticut. Learn more about local and national groups working for a fair immigration policy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.